Well, welcome to our Mary Hytken Dumont University here at Anshe Sefar Beth Lameth Congregation here in Memphis, Tennessee. And thanks to everybody for joining us tonight. We've been talking about the limitations of certain values. First week, we talked about various Jewish institutions, whether it was synagogue, the Beis HaMikdash, Kohen, and what are the limits of these institutions, which we obviously venerate and take very seriously. But there are some limits. There's some element of these being compromised because they are human institutions. Then we talked about kindness, which clearly is at the top of the pyramid of human activity, of human values. But we noticed that there were times when kindness is not in order. There are times when kindness, believe it or not in order. That's for last week's discussion. And now for the question of truth. So, are there any limitations on truth-telling? So I think we all appreciate the idea that there are times for where a white lie seems to come in handy and seems appropriate. You know, when is that? What is the cutting edge of truth-telling? How do we define that? Which values trump truth? And where does truth stand on the hierarchy of values? We should point out right away that if you look at... who made up that line of truth, justice, and the American way? Is that just in Superman? Right. But it's very culturally appropriate. The truth, right? In South Africa, they have this truth commission. There's a sense that we've got to get to the truth. Some people dedicate their whole life to bringing someone to justice. Someone to justice for a crime. So that's justice related to truth. But it's also the idea that we have to get to the bottom of it. We have to solve the mystery. We have to convict the criminal. It's part of justice, but also a sense of getting to the truth. Whereas, we have to think, what about in Judaism? Is that one of our major mottos, truth? Well, you say, well, sure is. Not only is there a verse here, if you look at the third little paragraph there, it says Leviticus 19, and you shall not lie one to another. Lo tishakru ish bamito. Which really, in that context, it's more about perhaps if someone says you owe me money, you don't deny. It's in the context of deny, but it does say don't lie. But even further, their first citation there, Exodus 23:7, is what midivar sheker tirchak. Stay far away from a false matter. So not only is lying forbidden, but we're supposed to stay far away from it. As they say in Fiddler on the Roof, may God keep us far away from it. Just to flesh that out a little bit, the Sforno, Italian commentator we mentioned the other week, he says, stay far from matters of falsehood, even from things which can cause falsehood. As it says in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, be careful with your words, lest they learn to lie from what you said. People might learn from it to lie. As a matter of fact, there's a special sensitivity when it comes to children. Telling white lies around children is more problematic because we don't want to teach them to lie. Right? Maybe they're innocent, they're children. We don't want them to get used to that. Sometimes if you say to your child, if the person comes to the door, tell them I'm not here. So they knock on the door. What does the child say? My father told me to tell you that I am not here. They're so innocent. And you don't want to ruin that innocence. So we have to be careful. So on the one hand, we have a clear mitzvah, not only to not lie, but to stay far away from it. Last time we talked about something that stirred up a lot of controversy here, and that is the idea that we as a people, we identify with the principle of kindness. Again, not the exclusion of any other nation, but we say, oh, as Jews, we aspire to be a nation of kind people. We aspire to be children of Abraham, who are Abraham known for his great kindness. This is true with truth as well. There's a verse in Tzfanya, it's not on your sheet, Tzfanya Gimel, Tzfanya, one of the 12 minor prophets, that the remnants of Israel, that's us, lo yasu avlav, lo yidabru chazav, the remnants of Israel would never speak truth, would never speak in a twisted kind of a way. So it's definitional to what a Jew is, and not only to what a Jew is, but Midrash Rabbah, your third source, fourth source, the seal of the Holy One, blessed be He, is truth. Chotamo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emet. It's a Midrash Rabbah in Devarim, Perek Aleph. It's a Midrash that the seal of God, if you had a signet on your ring with which you would sign your name, God signs His name with truth. That's very central to God. So clearly, there's no question that it's in the hierarchy of values. Clearly, in the Ten Commandments, we have you know, the idea of lo tishavu b'shmila shaker, and not to swear falsely, so swear in vain, swear falsely. They're related concepts, but is there ever a time for something else? So we have to, as Rabbi Lichtenstein, my teacher of blessed memory, said, it's important not only to teach values and to talk about values and think about values, but also to think about the theory of relativity, the relationship of one value to another. Because if we just think land of Israel is important, Judaism is important, truth is important, kindness is important, it doesn't give us any guidance as to how to deal with real life situations when there are conflicts between the two. Because very often we have to choose between values. So how does truth relate? How would it stand up if there was a toe-to-toe, head-to-head confrontation between the value of truth on the one hand and, let's say, modesty? Modesty in two senses. Modesty, you know, humility about our bodies and things like that. Modesty in that sense. Or humility of personality. How does that stand up to truth? Or protection of property of others. What if telling the truth might harm someone, or harm their property, harm their feelings, do any kind of harm to them, embarrass them? Then how would truth stand up? Will we still say, "Oh, truth, we're people of truth, you got to do truth," right? Would there be a time, would be room for, and then if there is room, is it room for a lie, or room for fubbing, or white lie, or, you know, in other words, how far can we go? We have to talk about that. What about peace? You know, keep the peace. If you don't, you know, if you don't spill the beans about certain things, and you kind of don't answer the question, take the fifth on that. It'll keep the peace in the family, in the Jewish community, wherever it is. What if it comes in conflict with Jewish peoplehood? Right? If you tell the truth, or, well, what if it, about your identity? If you tell the truth, someone will shoot you. God forbid. Those, you know, it's not a good. He says, "I'm going to shoot everyone who's Jewish in this room." So, you know, they say, "What about you?" You know, God forbid. Are you supposed to tell the truth? And of course, that relates to life. How would it relate to absolute life?
You're not supposed to volunteer something like that.
Well, volunteer. What if someone asks you a question?
Someone asks you, "Are you Jewish?" And he's got a gun. "I'm going to kill everybody that's Jewish."
Well, right. We know that life trumps everything. So the question is, one thing it doesn't trump is idolatry. So there's a question. Let's say, certainly, if you live in a pagan context, so the choice is you're either Jewish or you're a pagan. So if you say you're not Jewish, then you're implying that you're a pagan. Saying you're a pagan is tantamount to accepting other gods. One of the things we take our lives for is not to. Right? Also, can you deny that you're Jewish? How bad is that to deny? Isn't that sort of a fundamental thing? Then there's a question about Christianity more than Islam. The question is, Christianity, does it believe in multiple gods? Is that if you said you were a Christian, would that imply that you believe in multiplicity of gods, because they have Jesus and God and the Holy Ghost, and that's the Trinitarians? There are some Christians who believe in one God. His name is Jesus. So there are all types of different Christian theologies. Would some of them be tantamount to believing in different gods? So if you said you were that type of Christian, what would be the status of that? So let's take a look. First of all, we begin with a little problem. The problem is that although in Mishnah Avot 1:18, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, it's the end of chapter 1, of a vote of ethics of the fathers, on three things the world exists: on truth, on law, and peace. Right? That's not the famous. The previous one is more famous, but this is also there, that the world stands on truth. It's the first one, law, and peace. As a matter of fact, if you look on the bottom of the page, there, a rabbi from Kosov, he says that truth is the first one because it's the main pillar. It's number one. But we've got a problem. But also peace, and as we said, peace and truth can often, right? If you know, did you just say that you think that I'm a fool? You know, right? So peace can come in conflict with truth. So peace is on that list. Law. But what about this? What about on chapter 1, Mishnah 2, the very second Mishnah in the entire Pirkei Avot, right? The Reb Shimon HaTzadik, he was from the leftover of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, one of the last people we know their name from the actual great assembly of 120 rabbis, you know. That's why we have 120 members of the Knesset, from the great assembly in the Second Temple period, before the years, hundreds of years before the Common Era. On three things the world stands: on Torah, on worship, and acts of kindness. What's missing? Truth. So we've got a little bit of a contradiction. What does the world stand on? Does it stand on truth, or does it stand on Torah, worship, and acts of kindness? So you'll notice a slight difference between the two passages. What's that? Slight difference. On three things. I mean, aside from the three things that are different, but the introduction. On three things the world what?
Exists versus stands.
Right. So some want to distinguish between ha'olam omed, stands, and kayam, it exists. In other words, maybe the world only exists because there's Torah. If there wasn't going to be Torah, a guy would say, look, you know, it's very nice to have a menagerie with different things in it, but if the people are not going to be engaged in kindness, Torah, worship of God, they're going to pray to God. You know, then it's just a bunch of creatures. Sorry?
Torah's on the stands, not on the exists.
Okay, you're right. You're right. Correction. Correct. Yes, and according to this interpretation, you have to say that it's not true. That's correct. That without truth, the basic premise on which the whole world is created is not so much Torah, Avodah, and Gemilus Chasadim, but rather on truth, law, and peace. If there's no truth, law, and peace, then there can be no world. But as far as what keeps it going, what keeps it, God made the world for truth, but what keeps it going, so we could say there's a distinction like that. But here's an interesting comment by Rav Matityahu Tzari, rabbi from Spain in the 14th century. He says, there are times when one pillar overrules the other because they're all pillars. You see, when we say that there are three pillars, that means that each one is a pillar. We sometimes say that it's like Jason has a stand over there. You can't see it on the video, but there's a tripod. On a tripod, right, you say, what do you mean? The world doesn't stand on any one of those things. It stands on each one of the legs. So each leg is just one of the pivots. But Matityahu Tzari wants to suggest that no, when it says that the world stands on these three things, that means that each one is a pillar. It's an assertion. These are the pillars the world stands on. It stands on any one of these things. And therefore it could stand. But there are times, he says, when one pillar overrules the other. So now here we'll be getting into perhaps some sort of an approach and some sort of solution. One thing, right? That there are times when the pillar of truth will be supreme, and there are times when other pillars, like peace, will be supreme. Yes, Esteline.
I always told that this is like a stool. The world is like a stool.
Mm-hmm.
And if the pillars aren't equal,
right,
then the world topples.
That's what, right, I was just going to say about Jason's tripod.
Right. 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 That's a beautiful interpretation. It's the normative interpretation. You think if something stands on three legs and it needs all three. There's a famous midrash that Moshe said, what do you mean? You want to destroy the Jews and I'll be the only one left. The Jews can't stand with three legs. They certainly can't stand on one leg. Implication that when you stand on three legs, it's all three. But, in other words, if you couldn't stand with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you certainly can't stand just on Moses. But so that's a general assumption. Rabbi Matityahu Tzari has this nuanced approach. He says, no, the world stands on three things, any one of these things. But you say, well, then how does it work? He says, there are times. There are times when truth is most important. There are times, as we'll see soon, when truth is not the most important pillar. Yes.
What are the Hebrew words for stands?
Omed, kayam. I mentioned omed, stand. It's very clearly a simple word for standing.
Okay.
And kayam, it exists. Now, when something exists, it also stands. So, you know, you could say it's the same thing.
Not necessarily. But because it's, one interpretation maybe could be that to stand is like to blossom, to stand tall, like a tree. To exist is just to make it.
Good.
And so it could be that the ones to make the world stand up or rise.
Good.
The first three. And the other ones are more basic.
They're it'll just, exist, but it'll be crumbling. It could be a crumbling world.
It doesn't have to be strong.
Right, good. That's the same as Tiferes.
Yes.
That interpretation of Steve is the same as the Tiferes Yisrael here on their page, that the first mission is only to is to truly preserve the word. Second is just to barely get by, even without the first. In other words, if everyone would just, you know, there's a peace and the truthful, like I say, you know, if we have children who are truthful and they're not argumentative, you know, that's Dayenu, that would be a great achievement. If on top of that they have Torah and Agavoda and Gemilus Chazon, that would be great. Same thing with God's world, that if His world just had peace, all right, it's worthy of existing. This peace, this truth, right? That these are important values. The world can stand, where the world can exist, but to truly stand, to truly be, to thrive and not just exist, that you need something greater. So that's very good. That is the Tiferes Yisrael. Okay, now. One second. The limitations of... Oh, yes, I want to show you one more thing here. The Siftei Tzadikim, he was a Maharam of Kassav, some sort of a Hasidic Rebbe, he says that the... on three things the world stands, right? We see the value of truth is the first strong pillar. It's very strong because on which the world stands. It's a very strong pillar. And that, if you look at the top of page 2... you'll see the difference between two words, emet and sheker. Even if you don't read Hebrew particularly, look at those two words. The one on the right is truth. Truth, each letter in the word truth, the first three letters on the right side, they each have two legs, right? The aleph has two legs on the right, then the mem has a base, and then the tav has two legs with even one with a foot coming out even. But sheker, depending how you use a shin, some shins are very pointy. The sheker, I try to give you as pointy a shin as I could find. The sheker, it cannot stand. The shin stands on one little point. The kuf and the resh just have one leg standing next to each other. They're not connected. And the resh stands on one leg. So sheker, falsehood, it cannot stand. So emet, truth, is a pillar. It's truly a pillar. It truly stands. That's why they say lies have no feet. Meaning a lie cannot stand. Right?
Right.
The word or the concept?
Well, with Hebrew, it's all together. It's all together. Anyway, but now for the limitations of truth. So there are yes. A sheker. Like on Friday night, sheker achin, that charm is deceptive and it's a lie. But God fearing woman, she shall be praised. Someone could appear very beautiful, but the beauty could be a lie, belying. A bad character. So, the limitations of truth. We have a number of passages. We have Ketubot, we have Bamitzia, we have Yevamos, different passages that give different limitations on truth. It's interesting, they're not all... we'll have to see if the passages jive with each other. But first, a debate about telling the truth. So, let's see. Diana, would you read that for us? Beit Shammai say.
Beit Shammai says, the bride as she is...
As she is. That's it. When you see the bride, you should just say, as she is. We'll talk about what that means in a moment. Go ahead.
And Bet Hillel says, a beautiful and grateful bride.
Graceful. Right. You should go over to the groom and you should say, in the presence of the bride perhaps, you should say, ah, what a beautiful bride. But Beit Shammai says, no, you should just say, the bride as she is. What does that mean, the bride as she is? What do you think it means? Okay, good. She is what she is.
She's pure. I mean, she's, you know, what she is. She's not trying to be something else or covering.
Okay,
something.
Good. She's fine just the way. There's a saying that's similar to that, that she doesn't need any makeup. You know, she's just the way she is. Could be. Yes. Right, so we have some interpretations in the bottom. As she is, if you look at the italicized section right after this passage, as she is, Rashi says, according to her beauty, whatever, you can't, we can't, every bride, you go over and you say, beautiful bride, it depends. You could say, lovely. You could say, oh, gorgeous. You could say, it depends what you, Tosfot and the Rima Gash, Sephardic and French commentary, they both say, emphasize the positive. Whatever it is, she had beautiful eyes, beautiful ears, whatever it is. And of course, the other rabbi says, nobody's going to believe that, right? And others say, just as God created her. And that's sort of what Salim was saying. The bride is just the way God made her. Whatever that is, it's an ambiguous statement. We don't want to get into any lies. We're not getting into any insults either. We're going to just say that God made everyone the way they are. And I guess you would say that you would say it for every bride. In other words, according to the first interpretation of Rashi, she was very, very beautiful. You would say, oh, what a gorgeous bride. You hear people saying things like that.
But say it if they're not, anyway.
Ah, so everybody's they follow Beit Hillel, right. Right.
Well, all brides are beautiful in a way.
Ah, so, right.
Beautiful doesn't mean in every aspect.
Good.
If a bride is lame or blind, that doesn't mean she can't be beautiful and graceful.
Right.
So it's not a lie if you say she's beautiful.
Good. So now we get into what is... We started off assuming that there's something called truth, and we have to decide, when we're going to be true or not true. What do you mean? Whether this is a shoe, whether this is a chair, I guess not too many arguments you can make about that. I mean, some people say, you call that a shoe, and a lot of people say, you call that a chair, right? Some people don't like these chairs. But you can argue about anything, but some things seem more objective. But the question of beauty, and you're talking to the groom, presumably he thinks so, right? So what do I need to get involved with, or I think so? Or, that's true. No, everyone's suggesting that you should say something. I think there's an expectation. I think they're defining how do you make the groom happy. The bride and the groom, there's a mitzvah to make the bride and the groom happy.
Well, don't we go by Beit Hillel anyway?
Right. We go over Beit Hillel, and so then we run into the limitation of truth. He says, go ahead. Beit Shammai said to Beit Hillel,
if she is lame or blind, does one say of her, beautiful and graceful bride, whereas the Torah says, keep away from a lie?
Okay.
Beit Hillel said to Beit Shammai.
Shammai.
According to your words, if one has made a bad purchase in the market, should one praise it in front of him or denigrate it?
Now, we are comparing a purchase with a wife. A wife is not a purchase. There are some similarities. There are some similarities. There was an article recently, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, may have been in the Times, about the economic aspect of all relationships, right? There's a lot of economic elements to relationships. We can't deny that. There's a ketubah. But there's a transactional element. What can we say? But let's not overly focus on that. He's giving an example. He says, just like someone buys something and you don't like it, you don't insult them. Why not?
Because he might like it.
Yeah, and therefore, why not? So what's the value here? What trumps truth in this case? What is the argument?
Peace.
So could it be peace?
The feelings of the other person.
Feelings, right. So we have, what Jewish value or law is that? You can't not to hurt someone's feelings. Could be kindness. Could be from last week. Good. It might be a type of damages. There's an idea that if you, punch someone in the nose, God forbid, you have to pay for the actual damages, the doctor bills, and for the element of being embarrassed, and for their pain. So pain and suffering of any sort is a type of damage. It doesn't say, there's a verse somewhere that they use as the source of that. Where does it say you shall not damage? I forget exactly, but there is a source for that, because clearly there's something you violate because you have to pay for it. If you embarrass someone or hurt someone or cause them pain, then you have to pay for it. So clearly there's some sort of violation. So maybe that violation, not to cause pain, damage, suffering to someone else, that may be what trumps the notion of truth over here.
It's like similar to the beautiful and graceful bride who you really don't think is beautiful and graceful,
right,
or this purchase that someone's really excited about and you think it wasn't a very good purchase.
Right.
Your truth is not the same as the other person's truth.
Right. So
the groom To him, the truth is that the bride is beautiful. To the person who bought this, he's happy with it. He made a good purchase.
Right.
Okay? So what right do you have to impose your truth upon someone else's truth? It's like saying you're better than they are.
Even if you say you have a right, what obligation? Let's say it's a free country, I have a right. But what obligation do you have to talk about your truth? Speak in his terms, right?
Unless someone asks you, and then even then, right. Depends how you right. Order it.
Now, the rabbis have an interesting insight into marriage and into purchases. We do look to others to help us think how to feel. The whole idea of making a groom or bride happy at a wedding is foreign to those who have, let's say, destination wedding. They don't feel like they need someone to make them happy. This is the happiest day of my life. The last thing I want are my aunts and my uncles coming and trying to pretend that they're making me happy. But the Jewish idea is that no, it's more complex than that. A person on his wedding day is thinking, did I do the right thing? Is this the right plan? This is a big commitment. Is it last a long time? What do I do? And he can use, she can use some support. The aunt, the uncle. Right, and the uncle all come and say he did a great job. It's wonderful. This is a great match, and then they feel supported. It's a way of supporting. So your truth matters to them in a way. It does. You really
maybe.
Are. Yeah, it might. Right, it doesn't have to.
And maybe it
right.
doesn't.
Right, that's true. But the premise of making the bride and groom happy seems to imply that they could use some help. They could use some help. But in any event. Let's continue. How about the next, the Bava Metzia? Bava Metzia, Steve, would you read that for us?
As Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, in these three matters our rabbis are wont to distort, change, that is, not say the truth, their words. In a tractate, in matters of bed, and in matters of hospitality.
This is a very literal translation, very difficult to read it this way. But there are three things, just bear in mind for a second before we get the meaning, that there are three matters on which rabbis usually distort their words. It doesn't say lie. Maybe it means lie, but it says distort their words. So we're going to have to figure out, does it mean out-and-out lie or fib, where they sort of waffle? What are the three things? So before even knowing what the three things are, whatever these three things that they fib about, if someone asks about them, Rashi says, just say no. In other words, what if the answer is yes, say no. Rashi believes that is it fibbing or lying? It's lying. That whatever it is that the people ask about on these three matters, you can out and out lie. Other people say that the Talmud is not giving a license here for lying, but for ambiguous statements. Well, let's take a look. What are the three things? So, tractate. In Jewish circles, very often people want to, people compete. Like, you see the sets of Talmud over here, Mishnah. They say, did you study that volume? If you ask the kids in a yeshiva, they might discuss this. Or in certain shuls, did you go to the Daf Yomi for one cycle or for two cycles or for this tractate or that tractate? So, if someone asks you, did you study that tractate? Right? And you did. Right? Even though it's known to him, he knows the tractate. He knows the book of the Talmud. You should say no.
That's hustling.
If you said you did.
If you say no, you've known it, but they ask and you say no, I know.
I mean, it's lying.
It's lying. Oh, and you're saying that's what you're supposed to say?
According to, yes. The rabbis wanted to be humble about it. Right. Now, there's a spy versus spy game here. Everybody knows that the rabbi's trying to be humble, so no one really believes him when he says he didn't study it. But he still can't say, I know that. Right. There's also a question, what does knowledge mean, right? I mean, he knows it. Maybe he feels like he went through it, but does he really know it? Right?
He doesn't want to show the other person up.
Right, maybe the other person doesn't know it. Yeah.
So isn't there a way to say it? Like, I could know it better.
Right, so Rabbeinu Chanana would agree with you. It doesn't say he lied. He says he changed his words. Rashi's of the opinion that you say no. But that you can actually lie. But what value, whatever it is, what value here trumps truth?
Humility.
Humility. To being humble about...
Even if you're in a court of law.
Right, so that's interesting. Hmm. Right. We don't have that type of... We examine the witnesses like that. We say, well, yeah, really? You say that he killed him? Where were you during that day? And what did he use to kill him? And what was he wearing? And you know, we ask, and there he has to tell the truth, and nothing but the truth. And we have certain distinct people who are obligated to swear about certain claims, like if you claim someone owes you money. But we don't put, let's say, the defendant on the stand. So we don't ask someone to incriminate themselves. It's not even a matter of the Fifth. We don't even ask them. No, if there's no evidence against them, then, you know, there's no witnesses, then there's no case.
No, I'm looking ahead at the word bed.
Okay, bed. Yes. So moving to the next one. So the bed, what's a bed? So there's all kinds of unseemly things might appear. It might be, I didn't put it on the paper, it might be some sort of inappropriate question. Some question where the answer to that question is going to get into a very intimate aspect of that person's life, and they don't want to say about it. Did you sleep on that particular bed, in that particular sheet, and was your wife there? So you don't want to answer the question. Sometimes the crazy kids in class will push the teacher on some sort of inappropriate question.
Right.
So that's one possibility. Rashi says that it's someone asks him a very specific question of whether he cohabitated on that particular bed, he should say no.
Modesty has to do with sort of sexual things, and humility we mean having to do with being humble. Similar value, right? But sneeze can have to do with how long the girl's sleeves are, or something. And sneeus can be being sanua, being a humble person. So it's sort of the same diet. So this value is greater than truth. Sometimes someone who tells the truth all the time, maybe they're bragging.
So before I get totally mixed up, so it's okay to lie.
So in these circumstances, according to Rashi, you can actually lie. According to Rabbi Hanano, you can say something less than the truth.
Well, in your mind, you could twist it, say after something else, you can say, well, it's not one of these three things, but, in your mind, you can say, I'm justified, I'm lying because,
Well, we said before you should stay far away from the false matter, but if we could determine that something was a case where you could lie, then yes, you could be clever, rather than lying, you could be very clever about answering the question. Like they even said, if someone asked, is the rabbi in? So that day I was tired, I took a nap in the middle of the day, heaven forbid. So I was embarrassed, so I told my wife, don't tell anybody I'm sleeping, just say, I'm not here. So you could interpret that it's not a lie. Because when a person's sleeping, his soul goes off into heaven. So he's not really here. He's not all there. So maybe that's the answer. He's not all there. But anyway, so there is that idea that under certain circumstances, and so far we've talked about we don't want to hurt someone's feelings.
We talked about not embarrassing yourself. We talked about the idea of being humble. And in those cases, being modest, in these cases, you could certainly fib, perhaps even actually lie. Moving along. And what about hospitality? Steve, want to continue with that, hospitality?
Hospitality. If they ask him about his host, if he received him well.
Right, you went to that guy's house. How was it? Did they serve steak? Was the hostess nice? Maybe you're talking a bunch of beggars talking to each other. So you went over there, What did the wife want to kick you out, Or did she, receive you right away? What was going on over there? Would that be a good place to stake out? Go ahead.
He should say no. It is a good quality so that people who are not nice will not jump on him to come to his house constantly and abuse his money.
Right? It's not the one beggar's role to tell how good the benefactor was, because then you bring other benefactors. So it's an interesting question, right?
But that's just limited to a beggar, right? If someone has someone over for Shabbos dinner, you say, how was it? You say, well, it was beautiful. I mean, you don't say, no, the rabbi and Rebbetzin were terrible hosts.
Well, according to Rashi, that we're worried about not nice people. So then if you had a situation where there were nice people, as a matter of fact, the Tosafot, I didn't bring it here, but the Tosafot actually says something like you said, that you should always say that how wonderful the host is and things like that. So it depends whom the Tosafot says. It depends who you're talking to. Talking to a bunch of beggars or a very broad crowd, you're not sure who they are, then you got to be careful. Maybe you're bringing robbers to him. Oh, it's got wonderful.
Also insulting your host who bent over backwards to entertain
true.
It's an insult to Leah.
Right. It's clearly a judgment here. Right. 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 So so if you're talking to nice people, then clearly that value would win. You'd say, what do you mean? If someone was nice to you, you should be nice to them and tell other people how wonderful they are. But, so you're talking to comfortable people, they're not going to be running to get a meal in somebody's house. It's not, that would be the farthest thing from their mind. But, you have to use your judgment. If you're talking to people, you're not sure if some of them could be robbers, some of them could be beggars, some of them could be schnorrers, some of them could abuse their privileges, then that value would trump the value of being nice to your host. Right.
So you're protecting your host in that one.
Yes.
How would you handle if it were a matter of, maybe you were questioning if it were the kashrus? If you were maybe, I mean, and that's the host, and you're eating it or you don't, or you can't question, or...
I'll tell you one beautiful case I once saw. There was a rabbi that came to someone's house, and I guess he wasn't sure about the kosher there. So he came there, and he sat down, and he cut his food this way, and he cut it that way, and he moved it over this side, and moved over that side. And then he said, thank you very much. Yeah. Anyway, so that was his solution. But yes, very tricky situation. But I don't know is it a question of truth? Could become.
I don't know truth. I mean, you don't want to embarrass the person, but
if someone asks you, is that person kosher? Right. So you have an obligation to not mislead someone. So that's a problem. You can't mislead someone. But there are situations like this. Let me just think. Let's say I'm a rabbi. Sometimes there are people who come to town who want to raise money. Is it okay for me to say, if you went to that person, they would give you money? Right. So, right. Well, what if you know that they like to give? Right. They like to give. They told you to come and give. Right. That makes it a lot easier. But, are we saying, well, if they're nice people, right? They have a good cause. They're collecting for yeshiva or for poor people. Maybe it'll be okay. Maybe it's not okay. Maybe you're right? And in this case also, isn't it someone who wants to be hospitable? So you're going to help him be more hospitable. He'll get more guests. So you have to think about that. Moving along. Now, it mentions these three cases. But what about peace? The Tosfos asks the question, what about peace? He says, rabbis change their words for three different things. But everyone knows you change your word for peace. If you look on page 3, you skip the top and go to the Yevamot 65b, right? Let's see, Kay, would you read that for us? Rabbi Elai further stated on page 3, third paragraph, R. Elai further stated in the name of Rabbi Lazar, son of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon.
Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Simeon. One may modify a statement in the interest of peace, for it is said in the scripture, thy father did command, etc. So shall you say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee now.
I'll explain in a moment. Go ahead. Rabbi Nathan. Rabbi Nathan.
Rabbi Nathan said it is a commandment.
It's a mitzvah. Now, so what happened? If you know the story, the end of Genesis, the brothers have been living in Egypt land. Everything's going fine. But now the father's dead, and the brothers start to tremble that Joseph will now take revenge and kill them, the way Esau was planning to kill Jacob when his father died. So they said, by the way, we just want to tell you that, before your father died, our father died, he asked you to forgive us for everything we've done. Rabbis look at this passage and say, really? A, did Jacob know that the brothers were sold? Did anybody tell him? Number B, would he think that Joseph would kill everybody? Right. So the rabbi said, no, it's a baba maisa. The brothers made up a baba maisa in order to save their lives and bring peace in the family. So you can change, you can modify your statements in the interest of peace. How is it modification? They said, your father commanded before he died, saying, that he did command some stuff before he died. And then he said, forgive your brothers. So like two different statements. He commanded before he died. He gave a will and testament. That's the famous blessings of Jacob. And then please forgive your brothers. That's a different thing. So perhaps it's not a lie. Perhaps it is. Unclear. But the point is, the first opinion is you can modify your words. And the second opinion is you is a mitzvah to lie. Because there's a case where God tells Samuel to undergo some subterfuge in a particular case we can't get into right now. So there's a question that may even be a mitzvah to lie under certain circumstances.
Yeah. Like if a wife asks a husband, do I look fat?
He better lie. Right. So there's certain circumstances, definitely a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to lie. Right. It's a mitzvah to lie. Right. So we'll have to figure out why. Why is it trumping it? So then we have a question. The rabbi said in Bava Metzia on the previous page that they lied or fibbed for three things. But what about this? So the top of the page says, these are also because of peace. They're also more common, but they also be. In other words, if you're making sure that the rich person doesn't have too many people coming to his house, it's also making the peace. He's claiming that not, to be humble is also a matter of peace. So he wants to claim it's all the same value. Perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's a question of damaging others. Any pain or suffering to others, that's one thing. There's a value of humility that trumps. And there's a value of peace that trumps truth. Moving along, there's even a passage that claims that God lied, that God fibbed. Take a look at it on Talmud Bava Metzia 87a. It's interesting to note that a lot of Islamophobes, people who are very into every flaw of the Islamic faith, they like to say that, well, Muslims, you can never trust them because they lie for various things. It's mostly the same things that we lie for. But anyway, so take a look, very similar, right? Here's from an Islamic website, pro-Islamic website, claiming that the commentary to the Quran says similar things. You can, if it's reconciliation among people, in the narration of words of the husband and wife, right? So you can be euphemistic. Okay, moving along. Now, let's get to some applications of the question of truth and lying. So, telling grandpa, let's say, God forbid, a close relative of a sick man dies, should we inform him that it's time to sit Shiva? And he has to rip his clothes, and he has to take off his shoes, and he can't shave, and all the Shiva things. Should we tell a man in the ICU that he needs to sit Shiva? Should we tell a dying patient that, oh, we just got back the biopsy, you've got 2 months left?
Depends on the patient.
Okay, right. Now see, we live in a... Right, so I just want to point out, I'm not going to argue whether it's good or bad, I want to point out that we now live in a culture where we've swung more toward like patient autonomy. We used to live in a world where there was more of a paternalistic attitude. The doctor knew best. He would tell you if you he would decide if you live or die and if you need a treatment, you don't need a treatment. Today we have to ask you, do you want another treatment? You don't want another treatment. Do you want to have this kind of hospice or that kind of? So it's all about autonomy because we've swung to that pendulum where it's not a matter of his feelings or what. That's not so important. What's important is he has autonomy. And the Talmud is in the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, takes a position that no, we can be paternalistic. You don't. If a person is already very sick, we don't want to make him any sicker. Would they have a different attitude? Yeah, I don't know. You know, today we sometimes know with precision. You know, your type of illness, it's within 3 to 12 months. Maybe in those days they thought if you didn't tell him, he'll live much longer. But I think here you do see a little bit of a difference between a modern value of autonomy and decision making and that type of thing. There's Kubler-Ross and certain philosophies of dying that it's good to accept it and all that, versus this view, which says, no, as long as a person is living and a person is very sick, they don't need to know about all really bad news. Again, there are different people who would feel differently about it, I'm sure. If you ask different people, they would say, I want to know, I don't want to. People are more in control, they like to be in control, don't want to be. But I think here you might see a clash between some certain modern trends. I don't even think it's so old, but certain modern trends today. You have... So it doesn't matter even... But he's not going to say Kaddish for his father. He's the only son. No one's going to say Kaddish. This is a dying patient. If he's going to feel bad by knowing that he has to say Kaddish, then don't tell him. But there's a mitzvah for him to rip his clothes and to do... Doesn't make a difference. What else? What if... Let's say it's very often you have two parents who are sick at the same time. It happens. God forbid we shouldn't know from him. So the father is in the ICU, or let's say he's in a regular bed in the hospital, and the mother died. So the son is a dutiful son. He wants to come to the hospital every day, but he's sitting Shiva. So his beard starts to grow. He's got a ripped piece of clothing that's sticking out. He's got sneakers under, you know, under his suit, you know. And he's going to go visit his dad, who's dying. Right? So one thing not to tell the father, but can the son take off his ripped clothes, right? Take off, put on regular shoes to trick him to make sure, right? And the answer is yes. Great rabbis, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, yes, you could do that. You could override a lot of Jewish laws about the Shiva to not let someone who shouldn't know, to know. Yes?
Isn't there a story about the angel of death or something where the angel of death... Sometimes in a prayer, something gives the wrong name, so that
was that. Well, sometimes they change the name, so the angel of death won't get you. Yes.
So that's kind of
that's trickery, right? Interesting. Now, and there are some other interesting interesting cases. Could you, you know, we said, could you lie? The Rush said you cannot say I'm not Jewish. I'm an idol worshiper. You can't lie like that. The Rambam says, well, you could say, certainly with Islam, which is much more lenient, but with Islam for sure, just to say you're Islamic, it doesn't make a difference. You'll say you're Muslim, but you'll do all the mitzvahs anyway. Doesn't make a difference. But not with the children. They say, a lot of these fibs that we're talking about, not in front of the children. The children have to be protected. We want them not to lie.
But you can deceive. Like when they play a game instead of, you know, when they couldn't study Torah or something and they're playing cradle or something.
Mm.
Is that considered a lie? I mean, or just...
Hiding what you're doing. Right, as an element of deceit there. Right, to preserve Judaism. True. Could you say to a sick patient, you look great. You're looking so much better than yesterday. Right? Yes, right? Yes, you could. Now, why is truth so hard? Well, there's a story here. There's a story here on the bottom of page 4 here, where there's a city where everyone, let's see, where is it? Everyone tried to tell the truth all the time, and it's almost impossible. They tell a story, then somebody asks, you know, someone was washing her hair, so the daughter said she wasn't there, and then everybody died. I mean, in other words, it doesn't work. The point is, if you had a city named Truth where nobody told a lie, no one could live there. We would all die. You know, it would never work. In other words, the human being, just like we talked the first week, our institutions are not 100%. You can't always be kind because we live in a very cruel kind of world. And similarly, when it comes to truth, we don't really live in a world in which you can always maintain truth because there's so many different circumstances. The Kutzke Rebbe put it like this. He said, the world is all hiddenness of God. The whole world is a lie. That's why we can't be pure about truth, because the whole world's a, right, the from a mystic's point of view, this is all a big lie. It's just all God. God is everywhere, and everything else is a big lie. That's a mystic's view. Even not from a mystic's view, you could say that the presence of God is hidden in all places, and therefore, the whole world, if you didn't have lies, the whole world would disappear. That's why that city couldn't exist.
The whole concept of the different curtains that mm-hmm. separate, the farther you get from God, the screens, those are...
Yes, well, that's what he said. Only in the Holy of Holies, there there's truth. And that was when you have a true encounter with God, then you'll face the truth. But until then, everything is muddled. So I would say as follows. Let me just add one more thing here. Number one, that when they made the world, the Midrash said, when making the world, they asked truth, should we make the world? He said, no, it's a really bad idea, right? Because you can't, a world won't exist with the way human beings are. And also there's an idea of different levels of truth, which Kay and Steve were talking about before, right? He says, why are there different attributes of mercy? God is merciful, but he's truthful, but he's kind, but he's a judge. Which one is it? He says, well, God is truth, but sometimes he has mercy. He says, why? He says, because the deep truth is that Israel is holy, not sinful. In other words, you take a guy and you say, this guy is sinful as could be. There's no room for mercy. God has to be true. But the inner truth is that the most wicked person is truly holy underneath it all. So that's an inner truth. So therefore, God can be merciful, judgmental, and true all at the same time, because there's an inner truth, which gets back to the beautiful bride, or, you know, my father's not in right now. There are various truths, and sometimes the fubbing of it, it could be actually closer to the truth than we think. Finally, I would say as follows. If we lived in a perfect world, well, I would say as follows. Truth is not a value that's just an absolute to be observed at all times. Truth should promote human happiness. All values should promote human health and happiness. So if it's kindness, it should promote human health and happiness. If you're kind to a guy who's chopping heads off in ISIS, right? That does not promote human health and happiness. If we tell the truth to a groom when it's going to be hurtful and all that, that is not promoting human health and happiness. So truth, even truth, is there to serve the greater goals of the human well-being and human welfare and shalom and the way that all the briyot get along, the way that all the world gets along. So to put truth above all these things would be not recognizing that even truth is here to serve humanity. The whole world is based on truth, but it's there to be a good underpinning for life, not a harmful one. So perhaps that can explain why there need to be exceptions, even when it comes to truth. So I hope we've shown that not only there are exceptions to the idea of truth, but it's not the only value. When we talk about, you know, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, perhaps under oath that's appropriate, but the idea that our whole life should be dedicated just to truth, that putting truth too far up there, you'll see sometimes people who are unbalanced, who can't get along with other people, they're always pursuing that somebody did something wrong to them and they have to get them back, and they're just obsessed with pursuing a certain truth of a certain, and that's not how life works. So we saw the exceptions for other values did trump truth, modesty, protection of the human well-being and property of others, peace, life, perhaps affirming that we are Jews, that may be a situation you can't, according to some, you just can't deny that, anytime anything involves the hurt or the harm, even the spiritual or the mental anguish or embarrassment of others, that's a place where truth has to bend to these other values.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yes, I just want to point out that in two weeks we're going to be having our final settlement. Next week we'll take a break, Memorial Day and all that. And then the week after that, a final session about the boundary between spirituality and materialism. An overlap, not the boundary, but the overlap between spirituality and materialism. Yes?
The value of truth, or the product of truth, is trust. Mm. And when somebody is not truthful, then I can't trust them.
Right.
And it only takes one lie to destroy that truth, to destroy that trust, whereas it takes, 152 truths to regain that trust.
So I would just say,
and this is not, as best I can tell, this is not addressed at all.
Well, I would say the following. If when the person found out that you really didn't like the dress, realized that you were trying to protect them, did they, have you lost their trust?
Well, what about the teenager who skipped school and tells his parents
that... Oh, we can't lie. We didn't say he could lie. But if he finds out that he lied because he was helping a poor girl who needed to fell off a bicycle and hurt her head or something, so then you would, it's true he lied, but you would realize that you could still trust because another value had been followed, and you would be proud of them, and you would.
In any of these situations, somebody could argue that that's true versus not. You know what I'm saying? Any of the situations that you described.
Right, that's why we have the Talmud. Right, we only had certain exceptions, right? We didn't have others. Right, there's an interesting question. What if there's monetary loss? And there's so many interesting questions we could entertain. Yeah, the marriage, it's very interesting. Could someone lie about various things in marriage? So many interesting questions. Thank you.